All right. The Pre-K through 12 Appropriations Subcommittee will come to order. Adrian, will you please call the roll?
Chair Fine.
Here.
Vice Chair Bell.
Here.
Representative Alupis.
Here.
Andrade.
Here.
Bartleman.
Here.
Bush.
Here.
Hawkins.
Here.
Maney.
Here.
McLean.
Here.
Roach.
Present.
Smith.
Here.
Trunow.
Here.
Valdez.
Present.
Willight.
Here.
Williams. We have a quorum, sir.
Great. Well, welcome, members. Please make sure all electronic devices are turned off or on vibrate. Welcome back for our third committee meeting of our six committee weeks. Today, we're going to have two presentations that I'm going to give, one on virtual instruction and one on juvenile justice education in the FEFP. And the reason I'm giving them, I do all this work along with Denise and Ryan and others to try to get to the bottom of this stuff. It oftentimes becomes the basis of the legislation that we advance later. And I figured rather than just having all this information in my head, I would try to push some of it out into yours. So we're not talking about bills today, but I just want to share some of the findings that we have found in these various areas, because I think you will find it of interest. Virtual education is not a new topic for us. We began studying it and looking into it last session. And then juvenile justice education funding in the FEFP is a new area of analysis for us. But I think by the time the presentation is over, I suspect everyone will agree that it warrants our time and attention to figure it out. I'm going to do one presentation, then I'll answer questions. Second presentation, I'll answer questions. And then I'm going to have some comments to make at the end of the meeting. Some of you may have seen that I was with Governor DeSantis this morning in Brevard County for a series of announcements, and I'm going to make some comments on that at the end of the meeting after we've completed all of our other business. All right, so with that, let's move on to virtual education. And again, I'll answer questions about each of these presentations at the end. So you should have that in your materials. Oh, I have to do the clicker too. All right, I could do that. Reminds me of when I used to work for a living. All right. So starting on slide two, as you may remember, we started our discussion about virtual instruction during our last session. We had a subcommittee presentation on it, and we identified a couple of major takeaways. One, there were multiple options for students to enroll in virtual education. You may remember there were five different ways, not all of them available in all districts, but there were a lot of different vehicles that you could do virtual education. And then there was a dramatic increase in the number of students that were enrolling in virtual instruction in a district other than where they resided, excepting Florida Virtual, which is basically like a statewide school district. Moving on, we began to address these takeaways last year, and our subcommittee's conforming bill, HB 5101, which did become law, amended a couple of the virtual instruction statutes by clarifying the number of out-of-district virtual students a school district can enroll. We wanted to effectively make sure a school district should be primarily operating for the benefit of the students and families that are in that district, and then amending the FEFP funding methodology for the Florida Virtual School relating to some stuff for mental health. Moving on, this slide's a little bit of a refresher, but as we all know, the COVID pandemic had a huge effect on K through 12 virtual instruction in Florida. Some people didn't want to send their kids to in-person school last year, right? And if you didn't want to do that, and you didn't want to homeschool, well, the obvious way to get around that was to do virtual instruction. And this chart compares five-year increases in K-12 virtual instruction to just the increase between FY 2019 at 20 and 2021. So between 2015 and 16 and 2019 and 20, there was a total increase in virtual FTEs of about 15,000 students. And you'll see that at the bottom of the first yellow column. And you can see about half of that increase came from FLVS, and the other half came from the other five ways that someone could go to virtual school. Some of them are virtual charter schools. So the big ones, virtual charter schools, the second largest was an FLVS franchise where effectively a school district takes the FLVS software, throws their logo on it, and then just says, hey, we're a virtual school too. But if you look at from 1920 to 2021, the increase in 1 year was 67,000 students, sort of a huge increase. 18,000 of them from FLVS, and 49,000 of them from the other methodologies. Florida Virtual School saw a big increase, but all the franchises had big increases, and digital development instruction programs increased a lot as well. Now, one question many of you might have after looking at this slide, and I would have it as well, is, you know, it's now the 21-22 school year. Have all those people stayed in virtual, or have any of them kind of gone back to school? We don't have that data yet. That count hasn't been done. We haven't gotten it. I'm curious. You're probably curious. When we get that information, we'll share that. So we don't know how many of those people are staying, or it could have gone up. More people may be doing virtual education. We don't know that right now. But it's something I'd like to know, and I'm sure you all would too. So out-of-district virtual FTE. So current statute provides two types of virtual instruction options with the authority to enroll students from any school district in the state. So there is statutory authority for a school district to enroll out-of-district students. Those are virtual charter schools and contracts with an approved virtual course provider. As this slide shows, the number of students enrolling in a virtual instruction option outside of their school district of residence continues to increase. For FY 2019 to 20, there was an increase of about 1,644 out-of-district virtual FTE, but compared to an increase of not quite 5,800 students in that 1 year from 2019-2020 to 2020-21. So big growth. I mean, if you look at it, in 2018-2019, there were, let's say, 1,400 out-of-district virtual students. By 2020-21, there was almost 9,000. So, I mean, it's exploded in size. Moving on to the next slide, we're going to dig into five school districts have more than 10% of their total virtual FTEs represented by out-of-district students. This slide identifies these five school districts. Now, two of these are in bold, Hillsborough and Osceola. And Representative Valdez will be thrilled to find out that Hillsborough is in bold, not because they're doing anything wrong, because they have clear statutory authority to enroll out-of-district virtual students, because they are doing those two things. She got a little nervous over there. I could see it. But no, they're not. But the other three, it is not as clear. They do not have clear statutory authority in Duval, Gulf, and the big one being Hendry County. Hendry County, I'm going to focus on. We can talk about the other ones if people want, but that's where the overwhelming number are. Current statute does not specifically provide authority for contracts with approved virtual instruction program providers to have statewide enrollment authority, plus it's not identified as a controlled open enrollment school. In other words, some could argue that what Hendry County is doing is against the law. Moving on to slide 7. As previously mentioned, last year's HB 5101 clarified that the enrollment of out-of-district students is limited to no more than 50% of the total enrolled virtual students residing inside the district providing the virtual instruction. So you can't have a majority of your virtual students being not from the district. But it doesn't apply retroactively. It's only applied to any virtual instruction contract or agreement entered for the first time after June 30th, 2021. Otherwise, Hendry County would have to unravel this thing that they've created. But a school district may not enroll more virtual out-of-district students than the total number of reported FTE students residing inside the district, whether they're virtual or not. So again, because the fact of the matter is, again, school districts are created for the benefit of the people who are in those school districts, not for statewide benefits. For a virtual student that isn't, all right, I am on, okay. Now we're going to move on to funding. Actually, you know what? I'll take questions here. We're going to move on to funding. That's sort of the second half of the presentation. So I can go back to the beginning, but we sort of talked about the out-of-state. We're going to get into funding, whether they're in-district or out-of-district. You can come back later if you have questions, but does anyone have any questions at this point? All right, I was going to have a drink of water if somebody did, but they don't, so we'll keep doing. Oh, Representative Bartleman, I can always count on you. You're recognized for a question.
Of course. When you did this analysis, I was just Thank you, Chair, by the way. My question for you is, when you did this analysis, and I'm not, my district isn't on this list, which is good for me. Is it because Henry County is a part of, are they servicing children in smaller districts that maybe do not have Florida Virtual? I'm just wondering why they have.
Sure.
Are they so popular that everyone wants to be at this district? Tell me why.
Yeah. So we talked about this last year, and again, I'm not here to pick on Henry County, but years ago, the legislature basically said that virtual education had to be run through school districts other than Florida Virtual School. And so if you're an enterprising provider of a, I don't know whether it's a good option or not, but if you're an, let's assume, if you're an enterprising provider of a good virtual school option, then the only way you can gain access to a statewide audience is to effectively work with a school district and launder students through that school district. So it is our understanding, and we have a hard time getting a lot of information, to be fair, out of Henry County, but it is that the provider that Henry County has entered into a relation with will literally advertise statewide to attract students to this school district. And to some degree, how much can I blame the provider? They have a product they think is good and they want to gain access to the students. And we, as a legislature, have forced them into this student laundering situation in order to do that. The only statewide virtual education option is Florida Virtual School. All the others, again, it's, so it may be someone in my county, Brevard County, sees a Facebook ad for a, they may not even know it's in Henry County, but they see a Facebook ad for a virtual school and they choose to send their child there. So no, this is not targeting, we have no evidence to suggest this is targeting any particular school district, although, you know, if the company wanted to share otherwise, we would do that. But again, the issue is Henry County is a small county. We're gonna talk about it in a little bit. And at this point, one can argue that the Henry County School District is no longer operating for the benefit of the Henry County families and children. It's now effectively turned into a statewide school district. And that was never the intent of the legislature, to have students be laundered. And so, you know, one might argue, little hint of coming attractions, one might argue that if a virtual education provider is a great idea, then it should just be, you know, run centrally and anyone in Florida can sign up for it. Why do you have to be laundered through a school district if it's a good idea? You know, why shouldn't we make it easy to learn about and find out about if that's, and sort of like FLVS, why have to be laundered through a school district? So anyway, that answers that question. Yes, Representative Roach, you're recognized.
Okay. Chairman, thank you for the presentation. Thank you for the data. It's fascinating and I can't wait to see what's happening with the enrollment. But my question is, you know, Henry County is just to the east of me. My question is, I'm certainly not opposed to the idea that a student who moves counties and wants to stay within the same school or the same teacher, same virtual program should be able to do that. But is DOE allocating or removing or plussing up or taking funding from that student that's out of county attending a virtual school through another county? Is that affecting that school district's funding?
So I'm not going to answer most of that question because the next part of my presentation is about funding. But yes, if you are an FTE, if you are from Brevard County and you're signing up in Henry County for their option, you are reflected as an FTE of Henry County and not Brevard County. So Brevard County no longer gets the state funds. Henry County gets the state funds. However, as I will give you a preview of what's coming in the presentation, Henry County does not get the local funds from Brevard County for that student in Henry County. So the families, this is something we're going to talk about, the families who are actually paying the taxes in Henry County, the local taxes, that portion, about 30% on average, those families, that local funds, a huge percentage of that is being used to fund the education of students not from Henry County. So the local funds do not move with you. The state funds do. Yes, Representative Lupus. Oh, and I haven't forgotten about you. Representative Lupus, I just happened to see you.
Thank you, Chairman.
Don't ask a question about early education.
I will. I promise you I won't. So this is a new space for me. So on the accountability side, if a student is not living in Henry County but using the Henry County platform, are there scores attributed to Henry County, the county that they live in?
Is Just had to make sure I was right. They're considered a Hendry County student. Okay. Yeah.
And I didn't see it. I tried.
By the way, just like you can sign up to, we have wide school choice. If I wanted my son to go to school in Indian River County, yep, in a bricks and mortar school, we have that sort of physical choice today. He would be considered a student down there.
Thanks, sir. One quick follow-up. Sure. And then I looked through the, I didn't want to ask a question that was going to be answered in the next presentation, but do we have any sense of, from accountability standpoint, the outcomes for these different providers as it relates to FLVS?
We don't have that in this presentation, but that is something. One good thing about virtual education is it is not funded the same way in general as brick and mortar education. Brick and mortar education is funded based on attendance. Virtual education is funded based on completion, which, having gone through FLVS geometry with my son last year, it's a good thing because, you know, if it was funded based on attendance, they wouldn't have gotten a whole lot of money. But fortunately, you know, we had to get it done. We got it done. They get funded based on completion. So it's a different funding model, and one that I don't have an issue with, because I will tell you, you know, it's easier to some degree to make sure a kid's doing their work when they got to show up to a school every day. When it's virtual and it's like move at your own pace, there are issues. By the way, the virtual providers would not be very happy with that comment I just made. They'd love to be funded similarly to brick and mortar schools, but we fund them based on completion today. Representative Andrade, you had a question?
Thank you, Chair. Regarding virtual platforms, I think a lot of this discussion is the thought of the idea of counties entering these voluntary agreements with virtual providers. However, that we do have virtual charter schools in the state of Florida, and, you know, as a staunch supporter of school choice, we have in the past in Florida created protections for charter school applicants for brick and mortar schools. Have we ever distinguished between brick and mortar charter schools and virtual charter schools in statute and considered the differences?
I don't think so. But what again, virtual charter schools do explicitly have the legal authority to sign up students from out of district in our statute today. But see, if you want to create, again, just think this through logically. You know, you want to create Alex Andrade virtual charter school. And if it's a really good charter school, the thing about virtual is it doesn't matter if you're sitting in Pensacola or Key West, you're still looking at a computer screen. One thing for us all to think about is why should we make the Alex Andrade virtual charter school work with a district? Why shouldn't they just work with DOE and it goes on a platform and it's open to everybody? So there's this artifice that was done a number of years ago, which I'm going to show you costs a lot of money here in a minute, to run all of this through school districts, when I'm not sure there's actually an intellectual reason for it to be done that way.
And if I may, mm-hmm. Chair, have we considered the scenario where multiple virtual charter schools all apply through the same county? And what that school district will be able to do in that scenario?
I don't think we have multiple virtual charter schools. There aren't that many. We had it in the presentation last year. It's like a half a dozen total statewide. And I mean, there's really no, once you've created a virtual charter school with County A, you've effectively created a statewide virtual charter school. There's no real reason to go sign up in another county. So I think each virtual charter school, if memory serves, is associated with one district. Although again, they do have clear statutory authority to go statewide. But we force them to work with a school district, and then you can end up with this weirdness that we see in Hendry County. Although that's not a virtual charter school, but you can see this weirdness where a school district is no longer in the business of serving its community; it's in the business of serving folks from, you know, out of state or out of county. Any other questions? And by the way, you can come back and ask questions again when I do the second half of this presentation. Representative Roach, you had another question?
Yes, sir, and thank you for giving me a second bite at the apple here.
No problem.
You know, this discussion about the comment you made about the charter school in the county that may as well be a statewide school, I mean, lends me to ask the question that why is it that Florida Virtual School is the only approved statewide charter school? I mean, it seems that there's certainly a need and a want out there for some competition. I'm just curious, so why is that the only one?
Right. So first, Florida Virtual is not a charter school. They're effectively like their own, they're like a statewide school district. But I think to get to the crux of your question is the folks who sat in these seats before we did thought that was a good idea, you know? And look, but the world has changed. Yeah, we're going to do some presentations, I think, on the FEFP down the road, and we're going to talk about the fact that the FEFP was created 45 years ago. Like, the world changes, right? And certainly changed a lot in the last couple of years. But, you know, it's a different time, and I don't know what they were thinking when they made these. I don't think – maybe Thad Altman was here when they did it, but I don't know that the rest of us were. And so I love that, so I always make fun of him. But I don't know. It was whatever their thought process was at the time. None of us were here for that. Might have been a good idea back then. I don't know. Okay, I'm gonna move on to the funding side of this now, and then again we can come back. And this is the second half of the first presentation, so I want to keep that in mind from a timing perspective. So moving on to slide eight. Is this slide nine? Slide 8. Okay. It's my glasses again. All right, so we're now going to stop talking about virtual FT enrollments, and we're going to start talking about virtual instruction. So we have two different calculation methodologies for determining the amount of FEFP funds that are paid for virtual education. So if you're a virtual student that's enrolled at Florida Virtual School, that calculation methodology, they get the base FEFP funding plus six of our categoricals, and there are a whole lot. So they're only getting six. But if you're a virtual student enrolled through a school district, the calculation methodology is the same as the traditional FTE student, except the virtual student does not get the class size reduction categorical. But like, they get the school bus money, even though they're virtual. So to make this clear, and we're gonna get into what this means in dollar amounts in a second, but a student who signed up for full-time education through FLVS gets one amount. A student who's signed up for the FLVS white labeled product being run through a school district gets a whole lot more money. Same product, same thing, different amounts of money. So what does this mean in actual dollars? So we're on to slide nine. This shows the difference in the two methodologies. I'm gonna show you last year, but last year is not a good comparison, although it would if I was just trying to score points, but it's not fair. So last year, using the 2021 fourth calc FEFP data, FLVS got $4,477 per virtual FTE, and statewide school districts, again, they might be on the FLVS platform, might be the exact same product, exact same service delivery, they got $6,928. So you got $2,451 more dollars for not doing anything different at all. Now, that's not a good comparison. The comparison would be for 2021 to 2022, and I'll explain why in a minute. This year, it'll be $5,500 for FLVS versus $6,800 for our school district. So still $1,300 more. Why is there a difference here? Well, last year, as you'll remember, we no longer funded education based on enrollment. We funded education based on projections. So you got X dollars and you thought you were going to get X number of students. Well, FLVS got a whole lot more students than they were projected to get. So they ended up, it's always described as holding these school districts harmless. It did not hold you necessarily harmless. It only held you harmless if your student count went down. If your student count went up, as was the case at FLVS, it held you to a whole lot of pain, which is what happened at FLVS. So a better comparison would be this year, where the difference is $1,300. But the point still remains, same product done through a district is getting $1,300 of extra state money. And this adds up to, we're still working on it, but this adds up to an awful lot of money when you multiply it by the number of students that are focused. I mean, if you had 1,000 students, it'd be $1.3 million. If you had 10,000 students, it'd be $13 million. If you had 100,000 students, it'd be $130 million. It's a big number there. I just did it in my head. So, all right, so that gives you a sense of what the difference would look like. So let's get into a little bit more more detail on this. Current law requires all school districts with a contract with FLVS or an approved virtual instruction provider to annually submit a copy of the contract and the amounts paid per virtual FTE student to the DOE by October 1st. So we know what they're generally providing. DOE provided us with a summary of the FY 2021-2022 submitted contracts and costs, which is included on this chart. Unfortunately, but not surprisingly, given the world in which we live in, some school districts didn't think they had to follow the law, and so the costs on this chart are not reflective of all executed contracts. Interestingly, we don't really have a number for what Hendry pays FLVS. What they pay their outside provider. However, from the school districts who do think they need to follow the law, the chart compares the district funds per virtual FTE, meaning what was paid to the school district, versus the amount of the funds per full-time FTE the school district is paying to the provider. So again, you can see they're getting $6,841, and based on the provider, they're spending somewhere between $4,000 and $5,200. So, you know, they make a nice little profit off of each student that goes down that path. Slide 12. Oh, no, sorry, slide 11. One other aspect, and I gave this a preview before, this is about funding virtual FTE students. One other aspect is local FEFP funds. So, as you know, all virtual FTE students, like traditional FTE students, are funded with both state and local FEFP funds. For those school districts that are increasing the number of out-of-district virtual FTE, there's a corresponding increase in the amount of their local FEFP funds supporting these students. So the taxpayers who live in that district are paying the local taxes, but those local taxes are being used to fund the education of students who are not from that district. Local funds do not follow the student. For the five school districts that we talked about before and using the FY 2020-21 fourth FEFP calculation, Hendry's total virtual students residing outside of the district is more than 96%. So 96% of their virtual education students are not from Hendry County. If you look at this in the FEFP funds, it means that 40% of the local funds being raised by the residents of Hendry County are being used to fund out-of-district students. So it's a bad deal for those families. It's also kind of a bad deal for the families that are in the places that they're coming from, because they're paying taxes, and those taxes aren't going with the students. So with that, just my final takeaways are sort of twofold. Three things I want people to take away. So some school districts are enrolling out-of-district virtual students, despite the fact that it's not clear that it's legal for them to do that. Based on our current funding parameters, school districts get more FEFP for reporting virtual FTE students than what the district is paying the approved virtual instruction program provider. I guess I should have put this on there as well. They're also getting more money than Florida Virtual is getting for doing the same things, and not all virtual FTE students are funded the same because of this local funding issue. So this is what I was hoping people would take away from this presentation. Any questions on any of this on virtual education? Valdez? Yes, Representative Valdez. I can unbold Hillsborough County if you'd like.
So. I'm proud of Hillsborough County. They're doing all right. Here we go. Good job, guys. On slide 9, where you talk about the statewide average for school districts funding with virtual FTE, does that value take into consideration the students that are both brick and mortar and virtual?
This is how much money you get for virtual. So
solely virtual.
This is a virtual to virtual comparison. So let me say this again. So let's look at the bottom, because again, the first set of numbers make my point better, but they're not fair because they don't account for COVID. This year. A full-time student going to FLVS will stroke FLVS a check for $5,500. That same student went to Hillsborough Virtual School. If Hillsborough Virtual School was just FLVS software with their logo slapped on the top, they would get $6,840 for the exact same education, exact same product. It's $1,300 more. And again, at 100,000 students, it's $130 million.
Just wanted to clarify.
Yep, no problem. A student. But it is virtual to virtual. It is an apples to apples comparison. Yes, Representative Andrade, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. And you touched on it in Hendry County, the issue with the millage rate and, you know, the property tax supplement. As part of the county by county comparison, we have, you know, millage compression balancing programs in the state. I think 10 years ago, it was $140 million coming from state general revenue to supplement counties that weren't generating the same kind of FTE per student amount from their local millage rates. So if you have students coming from counties that do levy the full millage rate and don't get that compression coming to a county that does receive that state compression, would that result in higher amounts from general revenue that the state would have to supplement for students who live in counties that, you know, don't necessarily need that compression amount?
I think so. And I think really the point is that this creates distorting effects. You know, the FEFP was designed 45 years ago when you'd go to your neighborhood school and you'd like it. There wasn't virtual education. I mean, we didn't have the internet. So, I mean, there was no school choice. It was designed for, like, probably most of us. You know, where I went to school, there was an elementary school. That's the one you went to. And if you didn't like it, too bad. And then there was the junior high and the high school. It was never designed 45 years ago for any of this stuff that we're talking about, including virtual education at all, let alone a student in Brevard County or Santa Rosa County going to virtual education in Hendry County. And that's why there's these distorting effects. Ranking Member Wilhite, you're recognized. Unless, did you have a follow-up?
It was a slightly different topic, but going back to we have bound school districts, you know, to not outright or arbitrarily deny charter schools applications in their counties. If a county with an A++ record and reputation gets five applications from five different private virtual charter providers, in the same year, is there any protections for them in that scenario, or do they have to simply, you know, check the boxes to make sure they comply with statute currently, and suddenly they're on the hook for five virtual charter schools and almost no oversight from that county?
So I don't believe so, but that's also sort of a hypothetical. There aren't that many of these folks. I'm not aware of any virtual charters. And again, if you're a virtual charter and you can't get approved in County A, you can just go to County B. And again, you're effectively a statewide virtual charter school. You're just laundered through a school district. So, yep.
Well, my concern is a virtual charter school from, you know, South Florida, and I know us North Florida guys sometimes vilify South Florida, but a South Florida charter school coming up and taking advantage of, I don't know, St. John's County with an A++ whatever school grade. Suddenly they're traveling on the reputation of that county. Is that accurate?
Oh, that's true. Yeah, you'd be going to a school, right?
You're marketing the A++.
It's part of that school district, yeah. So, I mean, again, I'm not aware of, like, charter schools being denied and that sort of thing. There's not that many of them. But, again, the issue is, why are we running schools that function as effectively statewide schools through school districts? Why are we doing this? Again, when this all was designed, the world was a lot different. So, Ranking Member Wilhite, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I look at your page 9 when you talk about the difference between Florida virtual school or I guess we call it a bricks and mortar virtual school. And I would say the business model of a Florida virtual school was never to have a bricks and mortar. So they never had the capital cost of the school, the cafeteria, the PE, the buses and stuff. Where did the bricks and mortar virtual school now have those capital costs that they planned for, but now things because of COVID-19 have moved to virtual, that they still have to carry those capital costs and cover them? Is that potentially any reason why there is more going to the bricks and mortar virtual school than there was a business model that never accounted for that at all in the very beginning?
I'll ask Denise here in a minute, but I don't know what they were thinking. This was a decision that someone made at some point. I don't know what their thought process was.
See what I mean? Because
I just don't know.
Because
I know that if my son this year signs up to go to FLVS, we stroke a check for $5,500. If he signs up to go to Brevard Virtual School and take the exact same courses using the exact same software, not using any of those services, we stroke a check for $1,300 more. I mean, you can say that's okay. That's certainly a perspective to have. I think it's a fact that the same service we're giving $1,300 more to a school district than if they go to FLVS. And I'm not saying this. Look, FLVS is going to call me tomorrow and say, "Yeah, you need to give us that extra $1,300." So they're not going to, there's a lot of different ways you can look at this, but it is what it is. I don't know what their thinking was.
And Mr. Chair, and again, I don't either. I'm just suggesting that maybe that those capital costs still have to be covered whether the student is there or not, because the school doesn't get smaller because the student leaves. Those costs don't go away, whether it's the library, the cafe, all those costs are still there. And if one kid's on the bus, you still have the capital cost of a bus, whether there's 100 kids on the bus. Let me rephrase that. Sometimes there are 100 kids on a bus right now, unfortunately, whether there's the proper number of kids to two per seat on a bus.
But before you ask your next question, though, I would say, though, in Hendry County, where those 96% of students, they've never been Hendry County. So they're right. Getting $1,300 more for thousands of students that never went to Hendry County. No school was ever built for them in Hendry County. No school bus was ever bought for them in Hendry County. So I understand there are, I think there's a lot of different ways to work on it. And I'm not, there's no solution to this. It's just being proposed today. It's just pointing out, again, same service, $1,300 more. And there are some school districts that do not have the issue that you're talking about.
Okay, follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, of course.
You know, you said that the money doesn't follow the student. My simple question to you is why not in every case? You know, it was written in, whether it was the Hope Scholarship or whatever, all these things, that the money follow the student. Why shouldn't money follow the student wherever they go, no matter where it is? Because if the money is being allocated per student allocation, why isn't it per student wherever they're going to school? So whether they're in another county or not, why shouldn't the money follow them? Because, you know, if we want school choice and all these different things, we talk about it, the money should be following that student in every case there is in Florida, because the money is supposed to be used for that student's education, right?
I think we'll work on that together. I mean, remember, we've focused on state money. The state money follows the student. It's the local money that hasn't followed the student. I think it should. So we can. Hopefully, we'll work on that. We'll work on that this session.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Bartleman.
Can you explain the difference, please, between the two funding formulas that exist for Florida Virtual and which one includes the extra FTE costs? There's a part-time funding formula and a full-time funding formula.
Can you repeat the question?
Can you please explain the two different funding formulas for Florida Virtual School and which one includes the extra costs? There's a part-time funding and there's a full-time funding. So can someone from staff please explain that?
Well, I think what we're doing here is this is funded based on FTE. So two half times equal one full time.
Right.
And so, and by the way, that's on the previous page.
Right.
Chair,
can, let me
ask
it this way. So there are two kinds of funding formulas. Part of the issue is for districts is that we have a statewide requirement to make every student, in the state of Florida take a virtual class. Oh. That is a problem because you still have to have the bricks and mortar for the rest of their schedule and the teachers, as well as now a virtual platform for them to take the class. And I think that that would be relevant data, the two difference. So can you, I just wanna get the
That's a great question. What we're focused on is not that one required class. That's a fair question. We'll look into that. But this is not money that's focused on that. This is the people who are like truly going to school virtually. It's a fair question. We'll follow up and get that for you.
Okay, so yeah, I just want to make sure we're apples to apples on that. And then you said that local money was being used for the students outside of Hendry County, but if your premise is that Hendry County is making money on the virtual program, then they would have more than enough money to fund their virtual program and not use local dollars to supplant into that program, isn't it? So I'm just curious how the local dollars are going to those kids if they're supposedly this is a slush fund for them.
That's a fair question. It's a great question. Hendry County has not told us how much money they're paying to their provider. They couldn't figure it out. And it's apparently not the amount of money that same provider is charging to other school districts that they're working with, so we don't know, but you're correct. If the amount of money they are paying is less than the amount of money per state, then that issue, but we don't know because they haven't provided us with that information. Yep.
Follow up, okay, and then I guess an argument for Hendry County who hasn't come to the table to talk to us is if they have a good product and everybody is using it, why would we give the monopoly over to somebody else if they have something that works? I guess I'm just curious for the local school districts that have stepped up and created awesome virtual programs, why isn't there a level playing field for them?
These are deals that are being done and lobbied at the individual school district level. And I think, again, a reasonable perspective is something for us to think about here is that should virtual education, unless it's truly a district specific, if the districts really come up with something that's like their own, if Hillsborough County, then, by the way, if Hillsborough County's got a great virtual school choice, why shouldn't that be easily available to all students statewide? The bottom line is virtual education is virtual. You do not have to go to a place. And so what the idea is to think about should virtual education be pulled from school districts, made easy, made accessible, so that every virtual education option is like FLVS. It's just there, and it doesn't matter where you live. You can sign up for it and eliminate this local student laundering issue that we're dealing with today. I think it's an idea that is worthy of consideration. You have another one?
One more, and then I'm done.
And then, I'm going to try to wrap this up in the next 5 minutes because we do have to go to juvenile justice.
And I would just argue that maybe we should look at if they're doing a good job allowing local school districts to participate in this process. But most importantly, what is not included in this conversation, which is hurts all of our local school districts, is the requirement for the additional, for the virtual, because that they lose a portion of the funds and still have to fund the bricks and mortar that was spoke of, the buses and all of that, even though their kid had, and some kids are taking two or three virtual classes. So I think that has to really be a part of the conversation, because you can't expect local school districts to do the food, the buildings, do everything, and then take away portions of the FTE because of a statewide requirement to do Florida virtual, and then say, by the way, the only virtual you can use is Florida virtual.
Yep.
So
we have to be fair
to districts. Okay, thank you, sir.
This presentation's focused, though, on this fair concern.
You gave me
we'll
a lot to think
it.
About today.
Yeah, no.
There's
it's
interesting.
It's a fair concern. Yes, Rep. Lupus.
Chair, I just say, great topic. This is absolutely fascinating. I don't need an answer today, but I just maybe something we can talk with staff and get information out to the committee. You know, at the end of the day, and you and I have talked about it, the only thing that matters to me are student outcomes. So I think, you know, the question for me is, you've got these different providers. How many of them are proprietary to the district that they've created? How many of them are a copycat with their label slapped on? That's what's interesting to me. There's clearly a very different price point for the implementation of all of them. And I'm less concerned about the cost per student than I am about the actual outcomes of these programs. So is that something that we can sort of dig a little bit deeper into? Because I love the idea of choice in all aspects. But at the end of the day, the only thing that really matters, that should matter to us, are student outcomes.
Yeah, and it's fair, and we haven't talked about outcomes. We're just assuming these are all good options. I don't know. But one of the ideas is you sort of imagine a world of centralization where it's like, hey, you go to floridavirtualeducation.com, and there's FLVS and nine other choices. Might be Hillsborough School District's proprietary product. And you can imagine a world where on that page you would have metrics that compares the schools. Completion rate, graduation, you could put a lot of that stuff to make it easy for parents to do that comparison. But no, we're just talking about the money here. We're not talking about the outcomes at these various providers. It's a question worthy of consideration. I'm sure, like anything else, they're not all equal. Representative Andrade?
Thank you, Chair. I think that one thing I need clarification on is it sounds as if potentially Hendry County has a beneficial voluntary contract with their provider that's helping them potentially supplement funds. Is there also a scenario, though, where a school district doesn't have that kind of voluntary negotiated contract about how much they're paying per student? And in fact, this is more of an arm's length charter school relationship, like a traditional charter school brick and mortar, where the school district is bound to pass through the complete funding for FEFP and FTE per student. Without that leeway that would potentially benefit a school district?
That would be the case for a charter school. But again, the charter school is only one of the five. A charter school is a charter school. They'd be handled like any charter school. But that's only one of the five methods that's available to the school districts. All right, so Representative Smith is apparently trying to get my attention for a while, and I'm not seeing him. So, Representative Smith, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. And again, a fascinating subject, and I know because of COVID and the drive to more virtual learning in my district in Seminole County, we do have our own separate virtual school called ePathways. It's been very successful, and during COVID, many people have built to it. And I guess my question is I'd love to see the work, see the math, and be able to get look at my own county and look at those numbers that you've probably already generated. And I just want to make sure that I can get with staff and have that available, and then have some questions for my own school board and work so I better understand this issue, because I'm confident we're going to see it again.
Of course.
Yep. All right. Thank you.
There's always a method to the madness, right? So, okay. Any other questions? If not, we do have one other presentation on a completely different subject. And we do have one person who wishes to speak in public comment. Chris Doolin with the small school districts. And please keep it relatively short.
Thank you. I did not intend to speak when I came in. I thought your presentation was extremely enlightening. Hendry County is a member of the small school districts, as well as Gulf, as well as PAC, Heartland, and NEFAC. A lot of these programs exist because of the capacity of to merge and that. But I just wanted to say, I don't know what kind of communication has gone between Hendry County and whoever's asking the questions. I just want to make sure that this will get sufficiently vetted. Choice, transparency, accountability, and the terms illegal and laundering are pretty negative. And if they fit, they fit. But if they don't, and they're simply about choice, then I look forward to working to disclose whatever. And the one thing is, we don't know when and who and why this program was created the way it was. And that'll be interesting to look at. Thank you.
Thank you. I will say, in the case of Hendry County, we have been asking lots of questions for now more than a year. So
I've been on the phone with the superintendent twice today, and he welcomes the opportunity. And if there's any problem, I'd love to be involved.
That often happens when I bring things up publicly. All right, so let's move on. Thank you. Let's move on to our other presentation, completely separate subject. Yes. Will it go to the different next one? So we're now going to talk about something completely different, and this is juvenile justice education. So, which in simple terms is when a child has, you know, run into trouble with the law, how are they educated? So there's nothing, I want to be clear, this has nothing at all to do with virtual education, completely separate subject. So starting on slide two, so as it relates to juvenile justice, current law requires that education programs for four different types of juvenile justice services, and we're going to go through each one. There's detention centers, residential facilities, prevention services, and probation and community intervention. There's four kinds of services that have to be provided. And the school district of the county in which the juvenile justice service is located must either provide the education or contract for the education programs. And a quick little hint is not all 67 counties have a juvenile justice facility. So you're going to see slides as we go through here, and you may say, well, where's my county? It's because you don't have a facility, which is fine. We don't need 67 necessarily of all of these. Funding for all students, page slide three, funding for all students enrolled in a juvenile justice program is provided for in the FEFP, and the school district providing the programs reports the FTE. Current law requires that at a minimum, the FEFP funding for a juvenile justice FTE must include the base FEFP funding plus a certain number of categoricals, the ones that are identified on the slide. So this is what they have to spend. Moving on to slide four, there are 34 school districts reported juvenile justice FTE in FY 2021. Again, that's not that the other 33 aren't doing it. They just may not have any. Of these 34, five districts identified on the slide comprised 29% of the enrollment. The bigger counties are going to probably have more. Hillsborough had the highest number of juvenile justice FTE at 297, and Lake County had the lowest at 13. And you can see the six-year enrollment history of the number of kids that we're talking about here. The rest of the presentation is going to focus on juvenile justice education program costs and FEFP funding. We're not here to talk about why is a kid involved in juvenile justice or, you know, why are they in trouble. That's, you know, criminal stuff. Our job is, for whatever reason, are they getting educated? Current law requires all school districts enrolling students in juvenile justice education programs to annually report all costs to the DOE. The DOE is then required to publish every year by February 1st a comprehensive report that includes, among other items, all related program costs. The cost data included in this presentation has been taken from these annual reports. The box on the right of this slide identifies the three types of costs included in total program costs as reported by the school districts. So there's direct, there's indirect school, and there's indirect district costs. Slide six shows the five-year history of total costs for juvenile justice education programs. So to make this simple, we spend about $50 million a year on educating children in the juvenile justice system. But slide seven, if you look at FY 2019-2020, there's huge variation in total program costs for the school districts reporting juvenile justice FTE students. On the one hand, you've got Miami-Dade, it's $25,000 per student, and then you've got Hernando County at $5,358. So a difference of five times in theoretically, you know, dealing with juvenile justice. The next series of slides are going to go through each of the four types of juvenile justice services, provide a brief description of the service and cost information. And again, that slide shows you the by county. So slide eight are detention centers. These are designed for youth who are held pursuant to a court order or after being taken into custody. There are 21 of these. In general, the school district is providing the juvenile justice education program. Okaloosa outsources it, but there are very big variances, again, in terms of number of people and cost per student, as we're going to see on slide nine. Again, for this detention center, total program cost and cost per juvenile in 2019 to 2020. The cost range is fairly significant, from a low of $190,000 in Okaloosa County, a high of $3.7 million in Miami-Dade. But again, the program cost for FTE, $38,000 in Miami-Dade, you know, going down to $7,000 in Alachua, $5,000 in Manatee. You know, there's massive variation in cost to do the exact same thing. We don't know why, by the way. Slide 10 is residential facilities. So this is a different kind. This is a youth who's required to be in a court to stay in DJJ care for an extended period of time. There are 51 of these facilities in 30 counties. In 20 of the facilities, the juvenile justice education program is outsourced, and in the rest, it's provided by the school district. School districts have the lowest and highest total program costs. Marion is $14,000 for 61, that's the lowest. Orange County is $1 million for 73 students. But interestingly, we didn't put county by county, though we can if anybody wants to see it. What's interesting about this, again, there's 20 outsourced, 30 being done by the school district. Again, there's like unexplainable variation. You know, the contractors that are outsourced are doing this for $7,600 per student. The school districts need double, $14,500, again, to do the exact same thing. Again, we don't know why. Prevention services. This type of juvenile justice service has the least amount of cost variances across the types of services. So this is designed to reduce juvenile crime. It's targeting high-risk juveniles. There's 26 of these prevention centers in 22 counties. All school districts contract outside for education programs. None of them do this themselves. 21 use PACE, which is sometimes when people say, is that the PACE school for girls? It's that, even though they do more than just girls. But 21 use PACE, 4 do AMI Kids, 1 does North Carolina Outward Bound. This one has the least cost variance. Interestingly, it's all outsourced and the cost variance is limited. And you can see here, PACE, it's $6,200 per kid. AMI Kids, it's $6,000 per kid. And North Carolina Outward Bound is $5,000, but there's only 13 students. But there's, you know, a lot less, and you don't have these same sorts of, you know, interesting variations. And then the fourth and final type of DJJ program is probation and community intervention. This is an alternative. You've been charged with a minor crime. You're not necessarily in jail. It's got the least number of programs, with 9 in 8 counties. 6 of the school districts use AMI Kids. 2 of the school districts do it themselves. One school district provided a program has much higher costs than any of the other seven programs. And interestingly, though, here, not all of the AMI kids programs cost the same amount. So hopefully you're seeing the theme, and it'll be one of the takeaways, is there's just there's no solution. There's no hidden message here. It's something that we want to probably seek to get more study on, but why are these costs all over the map? So there you go, AMI Jacksonville, it's $15,000, but AMI in Dade, they're doing it for $8,000. And then this Strive Academy in Pinellas is $33,000 per kid. Again, same kids, same programs, very different. And by the way, it may be the ones that are spending the low amounts are spending too little. I'm not saying the ones that are spending a lot are spending too much. It's just you would expect a little bit more consistency than we are seeing here. All right, slide 16. We're talking about funding of juvenile justice education programs. As I previously mentioned, juvenile justice FTEs are funded in the FEFP, just like a traditional FTE student, except they do not receive the class size reduction categorical, but they do get the DJJ allocation categorical, which you'd sort of expect, because that's what it's for. However, for determining how much of the FEFP funds a school district must allocate to its juvenile justice education program, the statute identifying the minimum amount of FEFP funding is applied. And I talked about that minimum amount on slide 3. But as we're going to see on slide 17, it appears that school districts generate more FEFP funds to educate these DJJ students than they are actually spending. So taking care of kids in, educating kids that are in the juvenile justice system has become a profit center for school districts. Slide 17 shows that in every single county, and it's not all the same, but in every single county, the amount of FTE funds generated per student is greater than the amount of FTE funds allocated to students. And again, you can look at this two ways. You can say, well, that money should be helping those children, and it's not, and that's bad, and school districts shouldn't use this as a profit center. The other solution would be, well, hey, we don't need to give them that much then. We can cut that because they're not spending it anyway. I'm not saying which one is right, but those are sort of the two takeaways that you can take from this. Bottom line is educating children who are in trouble with the law has become a profit center for school districts. Oddly, the numbers that are reported, as you'll see on slide 18, don't make sense. Some of them are saying they're spending more money when they're reporting it to the DOE than when you actually look at their what they're spending in the spreadsheets and in the numbers. And this is a subject that needs to be materially looked into. That doesn't make any sense. The two numbers should tie. So takeaways on this are, I think things hopefully people would agree on. We should align the amount of FEFP funds generated to the amount that gets spent. You know, if we decide a certain amount of money needs to be spent to take care of kids that are in the juvenile justice system, then that money should be spent on that. It shouldn't be a profit center. And the second thing is, we don't know, and we should do additional research to figure out why are there just such massive variances for the same programs between different school districts. And those are sort of the two things we have taken away from this work. With that, are there any questions on this presentation? You're first, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair. And could you go back a slide?
Sure.
If that's possible. Just a question. My county, Seminole County, is not on here. Did we do something wrong, or did we do something really great?
I just didn't want to respect you. No, they don't have one. That would be it. They must not have one. I mean, we said not all, at the beginning, I said not all counties do juvenile justice. You must not have any kids who get in trouble in Seminole County must be sent to another county for their juvenile justice issues. Not all counties have, that was at the beginning. I think it was 34 of the,
okay,
of the 67.
Thank you. I'm going to go check on the ones I just visited to make sure they're not there.
Reason. I don't know.
Thank you.
We have not been, I mean, and this came from DOE, right? Report. What? Yeah. So we've not been given information from Seminole County. So that could be did they do mask mandates? No? Okay. It would be consistent then. All right. So no, but then we haven't been given that data. So it either we didn't have it for some reason, or They don't have those facilities. But not all counties do, so we assumed that if we didn't get data on a county, it's because they didn't have it. But you're right, yours is a fairly big county, so one would think that you would have them. But we were not given data on that. We'll follow up. Yes, Representative Hawkins. You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question kind of along the same lines. If your county does not have one of these facilities, does the money follow the student and that county has to pay the ones that they're sent to?
That's a great question. The FEF, the state FEFP follows the student.
Okay.
Yeah. So a child that gets, you know, in trouble in County X that gets sent to County Y to deal with these issues, County Y would get the funding, County X would not.
So to follow up?
Yep.
Would it possibly be that the counties that are charging more are the more receiving ones because of their getting more money?
We don't know. We don't know. We don't know.
Okay.
Thank you. I mean, what we know is there's huge, we know two things. They're getting more money than they're spending to care for these juvenile justice kids who theoretically need a lot of help. They're kids and they're in trouble with the law. And the second thing we know is the same program has widely, and by the way, some of the things don't make sense. So the one of them that jumped out is I thought, well, maybe there's scale economies, right? The bigger programs, but the one at the beginning, for example, Miami-Dade, which is the biggest program, has the highest expense per child. So you can't even say, well, it's a scale economy issue. We don't know. And again, the takeaway is, you know, we should ask someone to try to figure out. I'm not saying, again, it's entirely possible that we'll conclude that the people who are on the low end aren't spending enough. Oftentimes I'm looking to cut, and I am a cost cutter by nature. That is not, and I am potentially interested in cutting where they're not spending the money on the kids, but the purpose of the variance analysis is not to say there should be cutting, it's just to say there's variance and we should understand why. And we just don't know. Yes, Representative Bartleman.
Thank you, Chair. What doesn't make sense to me is if the program cost is at $20,000, mm-hmm. and their FTE is only at 7, if you compare page 9 to page 13, I don't understand how they're giving money back.
Great question.
If they're spending more than they're taking in, how are they giving money back?
That is a great question. The two slides to compare are slide 17 and slide 18.
Okay.
Slide 17 is what they're actually spending if you look at the spending reports. Slide 18 says what they say they are spending. Those numbers should be the same, but they are not in many cases. So it's a fair question. So when you look at what they're actually spending, when you look into the spreadsheets, this is what you come up with. When you look at what number they're just telling and they're putting on a piece of paper saying, here's what we're spending, there's no relationship between the two, and there should be.
Okay. And then my second question, which is not in any of our presentations, is weighted and unweighted FTE. So for members who are unaware of weighted and unweighted FTE, there's a base student allocation, and if you have a student who is ESOL, you have a student who has special needs, a lot of the population in our juvenile justice system have an IEP, they're going to get more money. So you can't, it's not apples to apples when you're looking, because you actually have to look how much FTE the student is generating, number one. Number two, do the program costs include all the money and the grants they're using? For instance, I was on the Juvenile Justice Board for 8 years. I've been to every single facility. My facilities have kids from everywhere. They come in, they get the FTE. There are differences in programs. For instance, one of our facilities, they come out and can operate construction machinery when they're done with their certification, and there is a machine actually in the facility for those kids to come out. Now, that didn't just come out of FTE to purchase that. So if the program cost is including grants, federal grants, a lot of times they're pulling money together from different areas, which may contribute to the higher program cost. And I would venture to say that the more money we spend on these kids and make an investment so they can come out with their diploma and come out with, if they come out with a technical certification like some of these programs do, that's what we want, because then they're not going to go back. So I just think we need to look. I feel like we get the presentation, and I get
these
that
are
you,
weighted. These
okay,
are
weighted. And so then that would be the variance, because depending how many ESE kids you have in that facility, you're going to get more money because it's weighted. So that's the same in any school because the services cost more. So if it's weighted FTE, you get more money if they're weighted. You get less money. And this is not per student. This is an average, I'm assuming, you have. This is an average FTE you're giving me. No. It can't be an individual FTE you're giving me because every child generates different FTE dollars.
Yeah. I mean, these are weighted numbers, so that should increase the denominator and the numerator, and it should work. If your concern would be correct if one number was weighted and one number was unweighted, but they are all weighted numbers. So I don't think that's the issue here.
No, but the issue is though is that you can have 10 kids, and if all 10 kids are weighted, they're going to be more. If you have 6 that are unweighted and 4 that are weighted, that's where the variance is going to come in.
But
because
you're
doing an average.
The numbers calculate out the weighting. There's no 6 and 10.
Well, but that's my point. Yeah. That would explain why some of them have higher FTEs based on the population. It depends on how many weighted, how much you're getting per student. Right. If you have a county that has a lot of ESOL students, and there are counties that have a lot of limited English learners, they're going to be a weighted FTE. If you have counties, and I would venture to say that when you're placing a child in a residential, depending on their exceptionality, you would hope they would pick a residential that could meet their needs. They would have heavier. So I'm just saying there's so much more to this picture that these people did not give us. And to have the conversation, you have to have all of the other pieces. And a lot of the schools that do the DJJ in our counties also partner with the technical colleges to give those students the certification. They have people come in and do technical certification courses on site, or they actually bus students from those places to the technical colleges to get it. So this is like incredibly comprehensive, and I'm glad we're gonna look into it, and I'm glad you brought it up, and I hope that we will, but I hope we get a clear picture of everything, because this little bit is just a snapshot. Mm-hmm. And we need to get everything and what everyone's doing. And so I look forward to the conversation. And I just wish that the DJJ and people would come forward, because then we make assumptions in this meeting and there could be a whole other reason that we're not seeing. And you opened my eyes to a lot, so I'm glad you're doing this. But I just want to just say that there is, just from my experience in my different roles, there's so much more to this. And it goes back to always outcomes for kids. Recidivism, who's getting their GEDs and who's getting their diplomas, and then how many of these programs are getting industry certifications. For instance, AMI, you come out with an industry certification, and those are additional costs, and those have to be factored in the per student. So thank you, Chair.
Sure. I would say this, and I'm going to move on to Rep. Roach. I don't know that I agree with you on the weighted, unweighted issue on for two reasons. Number one, that weighting is factored in both the revenue and the student count. So I actually think that comes out in the wash. But I mean, if you were to go back just to the beginning here, the first slide 7, I'm just going to take two big school districts that are next to each other. You know, Miami-Dade and Broward County. Miami-Dade's 25,000, Broward County's 15,000. We're not comparing, you know, a South Florida school district to some tiny little school district in the panhandle. I mean, even school districts that are near each other, which theoretically would have somewhat similar compositions, are radically different. But the big point you and I agree upon, which is this presentation does not explain, nor is it intended to explain, why these variations occur. The purpose of the presentation is to say they do exist, and I think we both agree that we should figure out why. But we don't know, and there might be good reasons, and there might not be. I don't know, but they exist. And this is a $50 million budget item, so it oftentimes will just escape review. And so we're giving it some time today and saying that we'll look into it. So Representative Roach, did you have a question? No. Okay. Anybody else? Last chance, because there won't be questions after this. All right, so I just want to make a few closing comments today, because some of you were surprised that I was here because you saw me on television with the governor in my home county of Brevard County earlier today. So I want to tell you why I was there, and I want to tell you a story, because I'm hoping that people are listening, because they should. A few days ago, a girl by the name of Sophia Steele got off the school bus from her government-run school in Brevard County. Now, Sophia is not like all of our students. Sophia is a special needs student. She is a nonverbal Down syndrome child. She has an overly large tongue as a result of that. She has a 504, an IEP plan that should have made clear that under no circumstances, you know, should some of this stuff that school districts are doing be done to her. When she got off the school bus a few days ago, her father saw her, and she was wearing a mask. Now, in my school district, we have an illegal mask mandate. But she was wearing a mask, even under their own illegal mask mandates rules, she shouldn't have had to. But it wasn't enough that she was wearing a mask, because she's a special needs nonverbal Down syndrome child, who, by the way, 3 weeks earlier, the school district had called the parents and said, your daughter's taking her shoes off in school. Could you help us to make sure she keeps her shoes on? But they were willing to call about that. When her father saw her get off the school bus, she was wearing a mask, and it was tied around her head with nylon rope. The mask was full of saliva. The girl couldn't breathe. Father's furious. How could they do that to my daughter today? So he went to the school, and he talked to the school, and he found out they didn't do it that day. They had tied this mask around her face every single day for the previous 6 weeks that she was in school. They just forgot to take it off that day before they sent her home. So when the parent said, what on earth were you thinking, to the teacher and to the principal, their answer was, the school board told us that our students all had to wear masks. There's a special place in hell for the three people who did this to this girl. This girl experienced real child abuse at the hands of the Brevard County School Board. And I will tell you this session, there's going to be hell to pay for the people who did that. Seeing no further business, Vice Chair Bell moves we rise.